You know, you guys don't know this, but and everybody's going to love me mentioning this, but we were just here 2 days ago because of the makeup episode.
This is like the laziest marathon recording ever.
Well, it took like a day intermission.
Yeah. Yeah. Enough for Ryan to get his
I
am recuperated.
Significantly more spry this evening.
It is true.
You know how I know, like, last week he had like some Gatorade. He barely made it through. Did you even drink a whole cider?
I had to chug like the last third of it.
And no snacks. He always shows up with snacks. And today you're back to the beef jerky.
I got the peppered beef jerky.
Did you bring some Chardonnay?
I did not bring any Chardonnay, but I've got some at home. I'm going to hit that shit up.
Ryan is always like, it's like the gong show of snack food.
Hey, man, I'm like into the haute cuisine.
Right, yeah.
Seriously. So we, our good friend, Matt Munoz, is back today.
Hi, everybody.
Welcome back, Matt.
Thanks for having me again.
You haven't done a show with Kevin. Kevin was on paternity leave last time, so I try to get them to not. They're sitting next to each other, but in case they get in a fist fight.
Right. I'm right in the middle. You put the Mexican in the middle, I get it. So we'll see what happens here.
The Mexican in
that is the sitcom waiting to happen. The Mexican in the middle.
Mexican in the middle.
In the tracksuit, by the way. Yeah,
like, well, the Mexican mobster, actually.
I'm wearing my Glendale, California best.
No, you're like the big guy. It's all like black sneakers, black track pants, black track jacket. You know, he's like the Escalade rolls up, the window rolls down, and Matt just accepts your money.
I am the picture of physical fitness right here going on.
All right, we have so much shit we have to do today, so let's go ahead and get out of here and go to the theme music. I'm Shane.
I'm Ryan.
I'm Kevin.
And I'm Matt.
And there's producer Mark over in the corner, and this is Somebody Likes It. Well, that was funny. He was, instead of, normally we figure out who's, we always ask, like, who's ready to go back in? And we normally pick a person, and Mark's like, everybody ready? And then
just screw it, man. Turn it on.
It was the general point in the direction of all of us, which was kind of,
it's like,
we all kind of look at each other.
Go, go!
Yeah. It's the new machine. It's like, you do it. You talk.
So, So Matt's back for our record this week, which Kevin picked, which is Jellyfish, Spilt Milk, and I'm sure we have a lot to discuss about this record. But before we get there, I like talking about some musical current events, what's going on in the world of music. I guess that's redundant. And this week, I'd like to talk about the fact that British neo-soul singer Sam Smith has been successfully sued by Tom Petty to pay royalties because his song Stay With Me is the same fucking song as I Won't Back or Won't Back Down by Tom Petty and Jeff Lynne. And God damn it, some of us, me and Mark.
That's me.
We've been saying this for a while, and now we've been vindicated, thank God. By the court system.
Fight the good fight, man.
That's right.
Can I just say, we won't go too far down this path, but can I just say that the best trials are musical trials? And another time we should talk about Billy Joe Shaver shooting a guy in the neck. But we won't do that
and
now.
Getting away with it.
Well, that's a little bit of a different trial.
We won't do that now.
That's Texas justice.
He was exonerated.
And
he saw
bullet,
no prison
the
time.
The bullet stayed in there. That's the best part of that shit, isn't
well,
it?
No, there's lots of best parts about that. Yeah. We definitely need to eventually
another time. We'll celebrate the anniversary of that hearing or something.
Well, this is sort of analogous to George Harrison, My Sweet Lord, and Going to the Chapel. Which is the first time I know of that somebody was successfully sued for plagiarism regarding a melody, which is kind of insanity if you think about it. Like with words, you can copy words. A melody is a little bit more of an amorphous thing.
It's the hook.
Right. I know it's the hook, but that's sort of like what is a hook? Like it seems to me that it could be easily successfully argued in court. It's got to be really fucking spot on. to get successfully sued and have to pay money.
Well, you know what has to be the best musical court case ever was the John Fogerty case.
Where he got sued for ripping himself
off because he didn't own his catalog anymore. He didn't own his publishing anymore.
And that was successful, too.
Yeah.
What was it? It was like Run Through the Jungle and Old Man Down the Road.
That sounds about right. I'm not sure what the songs were, but he got sued.
You need to get your fucking facts straight before you start.
I didn't know we were going to talk about this, asshole.
You're the one that brought it up, dude.
Well, you know, there was, I guess, recently, may still be in the court right now, there's another one. The estate of Marvin Gaye is suing
Alan Thicke's Blurred Lines. Yeah, Robin Thicke. Yeah, that's right.
About whatever his new song is.
Yeah, and there is a huge... they sound a lot alike. But I don't think they're going to be successful. That's more of a rhythmic thing.
Well, I thought
so, and nobody successfully sued anybody over rhythm before.
I thought Robin Thicke's reply, his press reply or whatever, was pretty interesting, which was that he was like... I'm a fan of Marvin Gaye. Like, I'm absolutely influenced by Marvin Gaye. And then of course, the show I was listening to kind of played them back-to-back, and you're like, you're really a fan.
Oh, no, it was...
Extra special fan.
Exactly. Actually, like, there was some of the testimony was leaked when he was grilled. What's it, when the attorney puts you up and, like...
Cross-examining you?
No. Just in a civil trial where they have you in a room.
Deposition?
Deposition. Yeah. Some of the footage from the deposition's been leaked. And in that video, he basically just asserts that they have the case. He starts putting the whole thing on Pharrell Williams, who co-wrote the song, and basically says he was so high on Vicodin during the recording of that and during the writing of it that he had no culpability in the actual song.
Plausible.
He just showed up on Vicodin to sing it.
I feel like that guy just makes one bad decision after another, though.
Mm.
But with this thing, you guys actually, I guess, maybe Mark did a little bit of sleuthing on the sonic signatures of these.
Yeah, Mark, did you go in and got a couple of clips so we can A/B this?
Yeah, I can put some clips up here for you, but I think what we ought to do is listen, of course, first to Tom Petty's original I Won't Back Down, and then we can listen to a clip of the Sam Smith one, and then I did a really, really bad hack job mashup of the two, so we can listen to that as well.
I think that sounds like a good idea. Why don't we listen? Why don't you just play one of them? Yeah, just do that in order. Well, I won't back down. No, I won't back down. You can stand me up at the gates of hell, but I won't back down. No, I won't. Oh, won't you stay with me? 'Cause you're Ryan hadn't had a chance to listen to those yet. We all three of us were listening to Mark's mashup and stuff beforehand. And what did you say?
Those are the same notes played in the same order.
<They're> judgment for the plaintiff.
Yeah.
So this is going to be a distinctly minority opinion, and frankly, I can already poke holes in it before I say it. But let me just put it this way. Well, hear me out. So one thing that I think is, yeah, this is a far cry from putting together the exact same notes in the exact order, but I do think that in order for songs to not sound dissonant, like, you're like, the funny thing is people think that there are lots of different formulas for original sort of pop composition, but the fact of the matter is like, there are things that either feel natural or they don't, and when you get heavily influenced by someone, I would think your propensity to end up some, like, on a similar track, not necessarily the same one, but on a similar one, is maybe probable even.
But it's probable up to a certain extent. There are three major notes in that chorus. One
Your
is
Honor.
A whole note. What?
Yeah, I said Your Honor.
one is a whole note. That Stay With Me is four beats. Stay with me. Or the first two are four beats and then two beats on the last note. Three notes there. in exact same order, exact same descending order. When you have such, you're right about, if that melody had been, like, say if you took an excerpt from not that this would matter because it's public domain, but from any sort of, like Beethoven's Fifth. But if you took, like, 30 or 40 notes, and then in the middle there were 15 notes that matched to a melody, well, in that case, you couldn't really make a case for it.
Well, no, you can't copyright, like, a guitar lick. But you can copyright like a whole melody that makes up the crux of the song.
I think the fewer notes involved. I mean, I think the only argument there is, does the won't back down? Is that the hook of the chord? Like Matt, you were talking about that earlier about hooks. I mean, is that the hook of the song? Won't back down.
Well, I think the most famous kind of one of these is the Vanilla Ice versus Queen. You know, under Queen David Bowie Under Pressure, and
but that was a sample,
baby. Well, no, because it wasn't a sample. It was actually musicians kind of going in and redoing the Queen and Bowie arrangement.
I always thought it was. I mean, it's exactly
no, it was actual people playing
it. A great clip of Mr. Ice, like playing them back to back.
Mr.
TV.
Ice. Yeah, I like that you addressed him as Mr. Ice.
Going
still has that play, pull,
like,
much pull
playing
with
like
you.
The Queen David Bowie clip, and then his, and he's like, see, it's like ours is do 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 do, and theirs is like do 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 do. It's like
it's not even yes, the displacement of that eighth note
thing.
There. Yeah.
He just tries to give it the slightest of different inflection, and
I had no idea. I mean, that is a good example.
Yeah.
I thought that was when we had a whole conversation last show about samples and the judicious use therein, you know, like how you can take one large chunk of a song, a la Sean Puffy Combs, and
I'll Be Missing You.
I'll Be Missing You. You know, basically he just took Every Breath You Take and made a whole song out of it. Or you can go and take Tribe Called Quest or De La Soul, where they just use tiny little bits. And no really discernible, I mean, sometimes tiny little discernible parts, but not really the whole hook or the whole song, and build new hooks out of little pieces. Right. And that's a little bit of a different thing. But having said that, I mean, you're right, Kevin. But this is three notes that are the recognizable melody. Like I said, if you had 40 notes and you had 10 right in the middle there, you could make a case that those were just accidental strung together, you're whistling one day. But if there were 1, 2, 3 long notes, then it's pretty open and closed, in my opinion.
Yeah, no, it's, well, at the very least, like, you certainly can't fault the judicial system for that playing out the way that it did. Like, certainly when they're laid on top of each other and one is slightly sped up, like, that's a pretty reasonably spot-on match. The other thing that I found myself wondering, and this is just the business nerd in me, like, there are services out there that if you're a company or whatever, that will just scour the web and scour, like, print editions of things all over the world and find mentions. And so there have to be, because there's so much money in it, if you strike gold on one of these, there's got to be something that just looks for major releases. That some piece of software that looks for major releases and looks for signatures that are...
Looks for a litigious opportunity.
Yep. I would almost guarantee it.
I mean, you're probably right, but that, again, that's a hard... It's a hard case to make. You're going to have a hard time because you just put forward, I think, which is, you know, the extremely obvious defense, which is, you know, there's only so many ways you can arrange notes, and of course... They can be arranged without you thinking about it because songs sound musical in only so many ways.
Right.
But speaking of musical, we should get to the task at hand. You picked this week's album.
I did pick this week's album.
Why don't you tell us about what we're in for?
Yeah, so you know, I thought about selecting this record several weeks ago or even months ago when we first started doing this podcast. And I'm kind of glad that I waited to throw it out here for a couple of reasons, not the least of which is Ryan selected the Run-DMC record, the last recording that we did, and it was a nice sort of throwback to a different, not necessarily totally my cup of tea, but a nice throwback to a different era. And this is This is a, you know, this is, in my opinion, a really terrific power pop record that is, it's kind of one of these deals where, and this is not the record that they said this about, but it's like this album didn't sell that many, but all the people who bought it went on to start bands. Like, it's kind of that.
Yeah, the Velvet Underground
exactly.
Phenomenon.
Yeah. And yeah, to a lesser degree. Yeah. But it's a power pop record that came along in 1993 in the heart of the... You know, heart of a very different sort of earnest type rock movement.
And we're talking about, of course, Jellyfish Spilt Milk.
We are talking about Jellyfish Spilt Milk. And so, yeah, so I think there are a lot of harmonies and sort of interesting melodic things at play and musical things at play that range from Crying Out Loud, from Queen to the Beach Boys to even the Pixies in parts. And I think it's frankly one of the pieces that I read, and then I'll hand off. Then I will pass the mic, as they would have said last week in last week's episode.
What's up? I wish you would have done that so I could have just thrown that in there.
Wiki. Anyway, yeah. So somebody called it, one of the reviews I read said that some might think of it as the Spruce Goose of power pop, which is to say this big sort
lumbering
of laborious
plane that wouldn't fly.
This big laborious thing that like could that was like a huge achievement but maybe didn't quite get off the ground, and I don't think it's that at all. So, and I think like 20 whatever it is, 22 years later, it, you know, it actually sounds pretty interesting. So, anyway, that was my take. And so I chose Jellyfish Spilt Milk.
I think it sounds, I had never heard a note off this album, but I had heard older Jellyfish. I'd heard their prior stuff. And,
was it Belly Button?
I don't know.
I think they only had two
records.
They
wore such stupid costuming that even at the time, I was like, I don't know, fuck this. I'm not
gonna
it
looks like they stepped out of the HR Puffin stuff episode.
Yeah, yeah. But thank you. These weird, like, high water, ruffly pants things, and, like this mushroom hat. And it was so pretentious.
Over the top.
And I was the right age to be into that kind of shit at the time. I have things I want to talk about this album, and you specifically, Ryan, I have a few notes that I want to see if we're going to mind meld again on this, because I have a feeling we will on a couple of things on this record.
Okay.
But Bill, you know, like how every so often we'll sync up and basically have the same notes.
It's true. It's like our menstrual cycles.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Mark's shooting me a really funny look now.
I think Mark's turning red. But our guest this week, Matt, I wanted you to get on this because I'm pretty sure I know you were like a college band nerd, and you have a penchant for prog rock.
I got to see this tour for this record, which is really cool. Of all fucking places, Amarillo, Texas.
I guessed right.
Sounds about right.
So you got some history.
And so it's really cool because I got to see this pulled off live, and I got to give it to them. To their credit, they pulled a lot of the stuff off live. You know, it's a very overdub intensive record. Lots of moving parts. Lots of nods to Smile and Beach Boys and Pet Sounds. And
it's pretty slickly produced.
It's very slickly produced. It almost at times. For me, listening to it now, it's almost unbearable at some parts, but then they bring you back in with the melodies and the guitars and the things that you need. You know, I think the Sabrina song, you know, I hate the beginning of it. It's probably my least favorite song on the record, but then it goes on first minute and a half, and then it kicks in, and then I'm in it.
I will say that for them, there's a lot of complexity. You're right about the production. It's of its time. Production-wise, has not aged well. Yeah. The sound of those guitars. But the funny thing is, when you get away from the core instruments, from the guitars, the bass, and the drums, the vocals and strings and choral stuff, and then like there's some curveballs. There's a pedal steel at some point. There's a harp. You know,
flutes.
Like that flutes, that shit all sounds really good. It's just butting up against what L.A. rock and roll production sounded like circa the early 90s, which does not sound very good.
It was right in the middle of fucking grunge.
There's one grunge song on this album, too, which is interesting.
You talk about joining a fan club? Is that
No.
All Is Forgiven is pretty rocking.
All Is Forgiven.
Yeah, I think it's All Is Forgiven.
And that's what they started their sets off on this tour with.
But, hey, you know what? Why don't we, Mark, why don't, or Kevin, why don't we listen to a song to sort of set the template?
Yeah, okay. So, and in fact, rather than jump in on the one that Matt suggested, why don't we start with the single, which was Ghost at Number One. So that was Ghost at Number One. It didn't end up at number one, but it did chart.
I don't know if it's meant to sound like it. It sounds like Ghost to Number One when you say it.
Yeah.
Like, subliminal. Yeah, they're trying to get modern rock
radio programmers.
Exactly.
And I think the second or third line in the song, he says, fuck, which everybody overlooked. And they still played the song.
Is that true?
Yeah.
You say fuck in a really sweet way.
Yeah.
It doesn't count.
You know, like, nobody ever know. Like, this is a shitty song from years ago, but it did chart really high. That EMF song, like, Unbelievable. It's got a Andrew Dice Clay
sample.
That's the Whoa. There's another sample in there where the guy goes, "What the fuck?" And it's all over the song.
Oh, that's true, but it's kind of buried.
What the fuck?
I actually really liked that song when it came out. To where I bought it on cassette, and it was the only OK song.
Did you see a couple of years ago?
Ecstasy, motherfucker.
Yeah, there was a Kraft had crumbles, like they were like little crumbled cheese, and they literally hired the dudes
from
EMF, and they had this. It was like, "You're crumbelievable," and they would like.
Oh, so I was like, God. I cringed. I turned to the TV when I was like, "Are you fucking kidding me?"
No. It was cringeworthy. Oh, number one, that they were using a long ago one hit wonder band
drug song.
But then when I found out that they literally hired the fucking exact band to recreate that.
So it's like Campbell's gonna like hire the Soup Dragons next to
same period of time.
You just get the impression that guy goes up to the drive through window with his check hanging out the window. He just won't look at anybody. I signed it. Yeah, I did it. This is what it's for, etc. So yeah, Ghost to Number One. So I think
it does sound like Ghost to Number One.
Does.
You're right.
Yeah,
I didn't even notice that before.
Anyway, now this was a song that they released as a single. It did chart.
This is the only song I'd heard from this record.
Yeah. And anyway, and it's sort of all on display. Like, the, you know, obviously the power pop tendencies. There's some Beach Boys style melody that's right in the middle. There is a lot of this sort of very, you know, the very slick production is front and center here. And, I think it's a record full of songs that have some chops, but this is the one that they chose to put out there as the single.
Yeah, there's much better songs than this.
Well, what struck me about this and kind of power pop in general is, like, how do you know which one's the single if you're swinging for the fences on every song? Like, they're trying to, like, nail down, like, the world's greatest melody on every single song.
Yeah, I have a mutual friend, Marcus Rice, who Matt went to college with, oftentimes said the exact same thing. Like, you shouldn't try to swing for the fences every single song. And he would reference this band in particular. And we also haven't talked about, by the way.
No, it's like the opposite problem of I don't hear a single. It's like, you guys write too many singles.
Well, I mean, but when you write too many, like, you know who's bad about that shit is the new pornographers. Like, they.
I want to cover their new record at some point. Yeah, and I thought about like picking a song off it, but I want to do the whole record when we do.
Okay, but here's the problem with like, and maybe this is really more of a format question, right? Because we're talking about the difference between buying records and buying singles or whatever, and now things seem to be sort of potentially, eventually, turning back to the LP is coming back. So there yeah, are
it's yeah, come back.
Yeah. Anyway, the point being is that it's a formatting issue, or potentially it's a formatting issue. This is a record full of songs that have great melodies, and so. You know, it's not, you're talking about how do you choose the best one. And the good news is if you buy the record, you don't have to.
But also, I kind of felt like after hearing one infectious song after another, it's not really of a piece. It's just a bunch of, like, a la carte good songs that happen to all be on the same record.
More of them should suck, you mean?
No, there's not a ton of stylistic variation, I guess.
Well, here's what we'll give you credit on. Then I'm sorry, Shane. I'll let you jump in. But Russian Hill, in particular, is like a nice.
That's by far the best song on the album.
Well, right, and you should write for Spin magazine in 1993 because that's exactly what they said.
I think it's the most interesting song on the record. I wouldn't call it the best song on the record.
I have a reason why I would say that, but. Not to get
why don't you go ahead and say what that reason
yeah,
is.
Yeah, tell us the reason.
Oh, no, he was about to say something.
Well, I think this is, and it's an interesting record because two of the key members left before the making of this record. You know, Jason Faulkner and Chris Manning, who happens to be Roger Manning's brother.
But I think Chris Manning was only a touring member, if I'm not mistaken.
But still, but I
Jason
think.
Jason Faulkner was a songwriter as well.
Chief guitarist, right? Like,
yeah.
Guitarist.
And, it, you know, the first record is the one I'm more partial to, Belly Button. I think it's the stronger record, in my opinion. But I still like this record a whole lot. And I think that kind of goes to the fact that when those two guys left and they had spent all that time together and actually really, you know, formulating a band and a tight-knit group, you get left with Andy and Roger on their own in a studio with Jack Joseph Puig, who's known for making these big records, big sounding records.
What do you know?
Like, for example, one of the records we worked on, the Aubrey Moore record that came out on Arista, that's really big and radio sounding and so
hot. Hole.
Yeah.
Yeah. Shane is holding his
he's pulling up Jack Joseph Puig's.
He looks like a fucking tent revival preacher over here. I'll give you whole.
I don't love this record. We're going to get into that.
That is the best
but,
thing
you know, to
seen.
His credit, you know, Puig did, you know, he's known mainly for, you know, a producer and a really great
Black Crows,
mixer.
John Mayer, Weezer, Fiona Apple, Green Day, The Counting Crows, No Doubt, Panic at the Disco, Stone Temple Pilots, U2. Yeah, big records.
Big records.
Big records.
He also makes Jeff Buckley's Grace, which is also nice.
You know, that's not in this little thing on his...
Yeah, sweep that under the rug.
Which to me is more important. Anyway, so going back to kind of, you know, the production aspect, I think it's... The fault with the record for me is that it is in a time where nobody gave a shit about big production, concept records, because at the time... You're in the middle of fucking Soundgarden.
Wait, I'm sorry.
No, you're. I don't think you're wrong.
I have to interrupt you. I'm reading Jack Joseph Puig's Wikipedia page, and I just have to say this real quick. So there's all of these bands that I was just naming that are like further down. But here's the first sentence in this. Okay. Okay, we talked about all these like huge bands. Okay, Jack Joseph Puig is a Grammy Award-winning music engineer and producer with a long track record of successful productions, comma, including the mid-1990s production of Tonic, period.
Oh, well, that's the highlight of the career
that's
right there.
Where you want to
I'm pretty sure the Tonic guys probably went into the Wikipedia page and did that.
Somebody, yeah,
Jellyfish,
somebody
the Black Crowes, Hole, John Mayer, U2. But the first sentence of his Wikipedia page has got to mention Tonic.
Tonic.
If she could only see.
It was probably Everson Hart himself who wrote that.
Probably. Wasn't wasn't Tom Selleck or somebody's kid in that band? Like, it was somebody.
Dude, if Tom Selleck were in that band.
Honestly, I think it was the lady who did Romper Room.
Was
I'm pretty
tonic?
Sure it was.
Let's
it
start
was
all kinds of rumors.
I think I'm right on this.
She was in Tonic?
No, she wasn't. Her son was.
Wait, what is Romper Room?
I've never heard
room?
That, but that's
is
good.
Like a, do you not know go Romper Room? It was a kid's show in okay, like the 80s. Anyway.
Matt, sorry, milk. I interrupted you.
So,
Mark, look that up.
Yeah, you know, and going back to what it is, you know, a concept album right in the middle of grunge where you got Soundgarden, Pearl Jam going off. You know, we just had Nirvana fucking decimate everything and change the landscape. So here comes this record, which, you know, charts on modern rock radio because of The Ghost at Number One, which is a weird single in itself in that time.
It is.
It's so odd, but yet they pull it off. You know, they're getting pressed because of the power pop thing, and maybe it's a little different from the grunge thing, but nobody really gives it a shot. And I think that's kind of the fault of it. It's not necessarily a fault of its own, but the fault with
well,
the
record. You know what I kept coming back to listening to this? You know who I think really loves this record? Ben Folds. Like, I kept hearing, I was like, is he in this band? Like,
yeah.
I had to look it up.
I considered that, but I mean, that's an interesting perspective for sure.
So this is my take on this record. Now, it's, and I'll just read you one of my notes. I like these songs. Good writing, but why don't I love them? Like,
I'm kind of with you on that. Like, you have, like taken individually in an a la carte manner, I think I could get into each and every one of them.
Well, and this is a later note that I made, and this is what I was alluding to earlier, Ryan. Mm-hmm. It's like the Coen brothers, all technique and no heart. Stop being so clever.
I feel you.
That's interesting.
Like yeah. That's well, there, there's
and
no.
Shane and I are synced up on the Coen brothers.
On the Coen brothers,
and we
sure.
didn't
Neither
find out
like
until like
Coen
what 17 years after
I know
knowing
this
each
comes
other.
Up like every three episodes.
I know because that's like we touch our penises together.
Like, Wonder Twin Hour. Powers.
Wonder Twin Hour.
Form of sketchy.
For me, the record kind of there's a lot of great things in it. It really starts and ends with New Mistake. This is, for me, is...
New Mistake is
the
best song
fucking best
record.
Song on the record.
You know what's interesting? And I want to say this real quick. There are... If I were Alex Jones, I would say there's conspiracy afoot. But there are three songs on this record that are 4 minutes and 3 seconds long.
And oh, that's a total false flag.
It's a false flag. for whatever reason, those happen to be my three favorite songs, excepting Russian Hill... Those are my three favorite songs on this record.
Well, name, but, now you have to name them all now.
Let's listen to New Mistake. Would you be cool with that, Kevin?
Yeah, let's do it.
Let's listen to New Mistake.
Maybe we can make a New Mistake while it's playing.
There's a couple of things I really want to point out about New Mistake since we just listened to it. 6/8 time, one of my favorite time signatures. You know, it kind of really what drives the undercurrent of the song, you know.
Nerd.
I know.
How is 6/8 time not the same as 3/4?
Whatever. Apples, oranges. But the other cool thing is, you know, Andy sings and plays at the same time. And I saw him do it live. And he pulls it off. And there's not a whole lot of drummers. You know, Don Henley doesn't fucking count. Levon Helm counts.
Don Henley doesn't count for anything,
yeah,
as far as I'm concerned.
But, you know, the drummers that can successfully do that. What else was I going to say about this record? Before we go back to Russian Hill and stuff, I think a lot of what this record is, you can directly see it to a band that was sort of almost broke through a couple of years ago called The Format, which later turned into this band called Fun, which ended up blowing up. But they have an amazing record called Dog Problems, which is, I would say, if you would play that record right after this record, you are in power pop heaven, if that's what you're into. You know,
I've heard a lot about The Format, actually. Yeah. I don't like Fun. I don't
I've known this about you for years.
I don't like
explains the podcast. Like good night, everybody.
I don't like good things.
He lives in a cinder block house. With
I do is pop my head up to yell at children and flowers. Okay? When the spring brings new flowers, go away!
Right. Join us next week as we talk about Siberia and the cold.
Well, they weren't
that's where I want to be right now!
The format weren't as obvious as fun. I mean, and definitely if you listen to that record, Dog Problems, it is almost, I won't say a direct ripoff of Spilt Milk, but it is influences on the motherfucking sleeve from that band to that band.
And as far as fun goes, like the band, fun, period.
That's what I was saying.
Yeah. Like that single, it's kind of a monster. Like, like it's over the top for sure.
Your uncle
like,
is a monster? Do we have some things we need to
It was actually
to
our uncle's birthday
great,
today.
And it's his birthday's today.
Happy birthday, Aww. Uncle Larry.
Happy
I'm
birthday.
Sure you're listening.
Hey, you know what? We haven't talked about, like, that I was thinking, like, without a doubt, the guitar stuff, especially in the first and on that song in the first part of this record, the dudes that made the band Maroon 5, other than the singer who is the most famous part of that record or that band, they are huge Jellyfish fans. You go back to that first Maroon 5.
Did you know Maroon 5 was started as a joke? Like they were like doing their impression of like a boy band and it just took off.
Well, the songs are kind of decent. I mean, I don't want to listen to them.
Kind of going back to what you're saying though, they were actually a band called Kara's Flowers that put out a record on Warner Brothers before they were Maroon 5, and they were...
Was Adam Levine singing in the band?
The same fucking man, different name, but they were more power pop than Maroon 5.
So I'm right about this, right?
Absolutely.
When I was listening to this record, when I was... Because that first single, what is it called? Like,
Goes to Number One.
No, that's a different band, you moron.
It's the band
we're talking about.
They,
I'm the dick.
Shane's such a sweetheart over here. I'm just
speaking of flowers.
I never know if you guys are boxing me in a corner and because you're making fun of me, or if I have to like. Overcome.
No, we're not doing that. I just didn't know what you were losing track of. But okay, I'm following.
Is this leading all up to you telling us that you really love fucking Maroon 5?
No, I don't. I do like that first single that they put out like 20 years ago, not like 10 years ago or whatever. Like, whatever. Anyway, the guitar lines in that goddamn song.
This love.
Is that the name?
This love.
Is that it?
Yeah.
Oh, you're nodding at me with a very self-satisfied smile, Matt Munoz. But, like, and you're saying you're, like it is
you
this love.
Because you coyly, I think it's called This Love.
I didn't know what it was called.
He's, like, got his Maroon 5 posters hidden away in his closet.
Here's the best part.
Not in my closet. Like the roof of my trunk, my car trunk, so I can pop it and just look at it and like pop my finger.
Give
and
your
like,
daily dose.
Keep on going. Well, keep on going strong, guys.
Have you ever seen the Sarah Silverman show where Brian Poulsen and I forget the guy.
Poulsen,
has their like gay lovers or whatever. And
yes,
so he sees them like rocking out. You know, every day he goes on his walks. And he's rocking out, you know, with his iPod. And then one day he goes to take a shower after his walk. So he looks at his iPod, and all he sees is one song in his iPod. And it's not a metal song that he thinks he's rocking out to. It's fucking Spin Doctors, Two Princesses. And so this is what I'm envisioning you coming back to Maroon 5. This is Shane Bartelton. You're in love with Adam Levine.
I have definitely turned up Two Princes when I'm by myself in a car. Like, I'm the one that loves you, baby. Can't you see? I ain't got no future but a family tree, but I don't want a brother love ought to be.
See, I'm more of a Little Miss Can't Be Wrong kind of guy, but they're both guilty pleasures.
There are two official fucking Spin Doctors camps. This is where I'm going to move my chair further away from you.
Oh,
because we could still be friends.
Can I just say that there's a Todd Barry comedy bit where he talks about, like, he's like, true story.
Oh, and like, saw the bass player reading.
From the Spin Doctors in Central Park sitting on a park bench reading
Bass Player magazine.
He's like, what are the odds? And all I could think of was, like, what are the odds that you know the bass player from the Spin Doctors? That's you know, funnier.
That's the only time that anybody's ever dropped a reference to a comedy bit in a podcast where it actually landed. So good job, Kevin.
Sure.
That was pretty goddamn funny.
Are we going to intermission?
We need to go to intermission, yeah. So, all right, we're going to get out of here. We'll see you in a sec.
Kids, we've got a special treat for you this week for a few minutes with, and that's going to be Van Halen's cover of the Roy Orbison classic, Oh Pretty Woman. And
which is exactly like the original.
It's just like the original, pretty much. And I'm sure if Mr. Orbison had
actually
done a video,
I mean, are you kidding? Because it's really similar to the original.
You mean without the 3-minute like drum intro?
Oh, okay. Remove that annoying, boring part of it that
and
I was
the
going
squalling
to
guitars.
No, but the song is essentially the same.
Well, no, I mean
there's
they didn't
not a lot of changes in the song.
And I did mention this in a previous episode of this podcast, but I did hit Roy Orbison in the back of the head with a plastic football in New Orleans once.
That old story. So, yeah, who hasn't really?
So that happened, yeah. And I don't think that's what killed him.
Why don't we play a clip from the song, and really, if you're anybody who could listen to this, you owe it to yourself to look this up on YouTube.
Oh, for crying out loud.
But we won't talk about it yet.
Right. It's
so
amazing.
Let's go to the clip. Yeah. Hello.
Oh, no, he already turned it back on.
Yeah.
I love how you sound like a prima donna on that, too. You're going to need a point at me, Mark.
Excuse me. Where's my makeup? Anyway, no. So that was a little bit of Pretty Woman, the Roy Orbison cover by Van Halen. And again, kids, if you haven't seen the video, you are deprived. Matt, you were telling us a little bit in the off-air about the history of that video with MTV.
It got banned originally. I think they showed it once, and then it got banned because at the end, I won't get
there's a twist
at the end.
Twist.
I won't. Yeah, there you go. I won't totally give a spoiler.
There's
but
a woman in, like, sort of in like she's being held aloft, or her arms are being held aloft by ropes, and she's being
danced around
and ravaged by two
little people
in maroon suits. And then the Van Halen gang arrive or communicate with each other about the fact that she's
via
being
phone,
ravaged.
Seemingly in different historical eras.
Yeah,
like
so
a very
so,
80s coked up village people.
You've got David Lee Roth as
Quasimodo,
watching
TV.
Yes.
Of footage of the woman with the two dancing dwarves.
And then Michael Anthony, the bass player, is in full-on Bushido, like samurai costuming. And then Eddie Van Halen. Oh, no. First, Alex Van Halen is introduced, and he's in like a Fred Flintstone type.
Tarzan-looking thing.
Tarzan-looking Fred Flintstone
Linecloth.
Thing. And then you've got Eddie Van Halen, who is like a Western gunslinger
sitting near a campfire, also on the phone.
Yeah, Lone Ranger, but not on a cell phone. By the way, people, we're talking.
No, this
about
is like a corded
early
phone.
80s, like this is
at least a nice Conair plastic.
It's a
touch style phone.
And just then at some point, for no reason, and again, not that there's any reason in this video, but for no
none.
Reason,
it's none.
Some, there's none. For no reason,
it's Dada.
David Lee Roth morphs. Randomly morphs into Napoleon for a little while.
Yeah, like he shows up as Napoleon, and
he's sitting at a table eating his whatever breakfast he's eating
at a giant table.
At a giant,
and then walks majestically down a giant hall, and then shows up in a limo.
It's truly bizarre. When
which I've seen him do in real life, which Ryan is really fucked up.
Ryan and I were oh, you have? Yeah. Oh, tell us some David Lee Roth stories.
Well, it's funny. I went and saw that Sam and Dave tour, which was both, you know, lead singers of Van Halen, Sammy Hagar and David Lee Roth. They did a tour together. I guess it was, gosh.
Was that kind of aborted midway?
No, they went all the way.
But no, that's when he
weird and awkward?
It was weird and awkward because the Roth went on first. Anyway, the best part of it is we were back there. It was at the Universal Amphitheater, which I think now is gone. But so they have a cool back area, and you can drink beers or whatever. And literally, you know, there's a big opening where the artists arrive, and we thought everybody had got there. But, of course, about 10 minutes before his set time, Roth pulls up in a limousine. And I shit you not, it's like a fucking video from Van Halen 80s era. He comes out. First of all, there's these two twins in blue bodysuits, Spandex bodysuits, come out. And then they pull him out. And then he, you know, it's a show. He walks
Diamond
through
the
fucking crowd. Yeah. And everybody's like politely applauding, Dave, Dave. And he goes backstage to his dressing room. And it was pretty fucking rock and roll. It was pretty fucking rock and roll.
He's one of those guys that still prescribes or subscribes to the...
But I got to ask you, why did you pick this video?
Oh, what was that with the words I used, like Shane and I were going back and forth.
Yeah,
on,
you
like,
said like elegantly,
sublimely weird.
Sublimely weird.
It's
right.
The most surreal, like mainstream rock video I've ever seen, and I didn't see it till like maybe 2-3 years ago. It was on like a
really wow
yeah like it was on there's like life, there's like a local channel a local cable channel that was like showing or maybe, it wasn't even cable. It was like one of the like digital
air.
Things.
Yeah.
And I was like, what the fuck is this? Dude,
like, I can't stand the music of Van Halen, but
I love
I know, Van Halen. I know. A lot of people do. It's just...
I'm not crazy about Van Hagar, but I really like old Van Halen.
You and I are on the same page about
that.
Well, the weird thing, this record, Diver Down, really is a record that should have never been made.
Well, no.
Why
is
that?
You guys didn't let me put my little
punctuation.
I can't stand Van Halen, but I would watch that video 1,000 more times.
Imagine,
and I'm not kidding.
Imagine,
I will watch it again when I go home tonight. That's one of the most entertaining things I've ever seen.
I couldn't believe what I was seeing when I knew the song. I'm like, what is happening right now?
I love the way you said that. It was sort of like you were like moving, like you weren't, but it sounded like when somebody just moves their head around the mic.
I don't fucking understand this.
It's like you feel like there's a headline. It's like Van Halen made a video. And you won't believe what happened next.
No, really, you won't.
All the clickbait.
We could explain it to you, and it would make no difference. You would still not believe it.
Well, it's crazy because at the time, this ended up being their biggest charting single.
Well, I remember the song.
When was this?
This is 80. This is 83, 82. So,
that explains
the production.
You know,
they had just come off a killer rock and roll record, Fair Warning. They did an extensive, almost year and a half, 2 year tour on it of the world. They were not supposed to make this record. It ended up being half the record is covers. It's this. It's Where Have All the Good Times Gone by the Kinks, Dancing in the Streets by Martha and the Vandellas. So it's like, you know, Sweet William Now at the end. It's a covers record.
It was basically Warner saying like, hey, give us some product.
Hurry up, get into the fucking studio and make another record. And then subsequently, they end up getting their biggest single, you know, of the time with this song in the video because of the
weren't
controversy.
They discovered by Gene Simmons.
Yeah, it's true.
Not incorrect.
No doubt. It's hard for me to believe that Gene Simmons discovered anything as much time as that guy since.
Thinking about
just looking at himself.
And looking at other people looking at him.
At himself.
This is totally fucking true, but I have been in a restaurant in New York, I don't know, it's like maybe 10 years ago, and it just so happened that Gene Simmons was in the same restaurant, and I watched that guy. I looked over and I was like, oh shit, that's Gene Simmons. And then I watched him see that I noticed who he was. And then I watched him get up from table to table. And he walked at like 3 or 4 tables and just chatted people
up. Hey, I'm Gene Simmons.
Kept looking back. And I was like, I don't know who you think I am. Like, I'm just a dude. But anyway, yeah, I get the feeling that happens with him a lot.
Has there?
It's like, not that he's just recognizable, but that there's a weird shit that goes on in the guy's life.
Has it? The question should be posited. Has there ever existed a bigger piece of shit on the face of the planet than Gene Simmons? Like a bigger asshole? Like a bigger
Hitler,
like,
maybe?
I mean, like more of a narcissist. Okay, let's make a list. Let's wrap it in these terms. Has there ever existed a bigger money hungry narcissist than Gene Simmons? On the face of the planet.
And that still is probable. But he's on
I think it's him and Donald Trump.
Yeah, he's in the Hall of Fame.
Donald Trump?
Yeah. He might be locked in an eternal battle.
I will say this, that when that whole thing went down, it was among the most comical things. It's like watching somebody who's not self-aware do something stupid. And get the idea that that person – we talked early in the cycle of doing this podcast about how one of the things that you have to sort of commit to if you're going to be famous is to do crazy shit that nobody else will do. But sometimes those aren't always good ideas.
And I don't know if this video was a good idea. I mean, to me now, I think it's a great idea, but I don't know how they storyboarded this shit. Like, there is zero
narrative.
You think
there was a storyboard?
Well, here's the thing. I challenge.
There's a lot of drugs in the
storyboard. I would love for somebody who listens to this to come up with some sort of linear narrative for, like, what's happening in this video, because I would just love to know. Also, like, they had a budget. Why did they shoot the thing on Betamax? Like, it looks like a fucking 80s porn video.
All of that's true.
We should probably move this along.
Okay,
kids.
So we gotta get back.
Let's get out of this and get back into Jellyfish.
Let's get back to the item at hand, which is
spilt milk. Can I just say that the kid on the cover of this record looks like she's really not having a good time?
No, you know what she looks like? She looks like the bad time twin of the Bumblebee girl.
The bee girl. I was totally thinking about that. Like
the bad time.
Well, no, she looks like a 4-year-old redheaded Don Wiener from Welcome to the Dollhouse.
Right.
Did they intentionally, like, do something to upset her?
No, they gave the Bumblebee girl a lot of sugar, wound her up, made her listen to shitty music, and then that picture of her on the cover of this record is the morning after. It's her coming down, looking at herself in the mirror going,
what have I done?
For me, it's the worst part of the record is the fucking album cover. It really is. It's bad.
Yeah, and there's a lot of groundswell. There certainly was a lot of groundswell when this record came out about how the record covers seem like throwaways, and I think that's frankly, like, reasonably warranted.
That's
like,
valid.
It's like, yeah. It's like, especially when you listen to what the production value is of what goes sonically into the to making that record.
Oh, they put so much attention into the production and nothing into the
cover. It's like the album cover is a fart.
Like, that album came out the same year as, or that single came, or whatever, not, that wasn't the single, but, came out the same year as what's the name of the goddamn band with the Bumblebee Girl?
Oh, Blind Melon. Saw play with Smashing Pumpkins on what we called the Produce Tour.
I think they came out the same month of 1993, so they're easily back to back.
But something that you did also bring up off the air, which I'm going to bring back around, is John Bryan is on this record, who, you know, has worked with Elliott Smith.
The uber L.A. sort of indie producer.
Well, he was quasi-indie. He's got that thing at Largo every Monday.
He's part of that Largo elite club with Amy Mann and...
Matt, you lived in L.A. for 10 years.
I went to
years.
A lot of those John Bryan. He had a Friday
night
show.
Why don't you explain to everybody what Largo, the whole thing about that
it's
is?
It's kind of like a bigger Cactus Cafe. It was a little bit not tremendously much bigger, but the intimacy was the thing. He would literally throw you out if you had your cell phone on. Flanagan, the guy that runs the place. If your cell phone was on, you could order food. There was really bad food. But it's got tables. It's got candles. It's a small stage just like the Cactus. There's an old beat-up piano. David, when he lived out there, played Fiona Apple. Oh, I saw Amy Mann. Lots of people.
A lot of
But it's like Amy Mann, Fiona Apple, Michael Penn.
Yep.
Like there's like a cabal of like sort of inner people that are the Largo folks.
Yep.
I like it that you say cabal, because I like to think about like pasty, weak musicians, like having some sort of like illicit trade where they would like drive up to this like black dark SUV wherein Matt Munoz would roll down the windows in his tracksuit and be like, did you guys bring the lyrics to some new song? Say cabal.
It's a weird lyric trading fatwa.
Look, there's a reason why Matt came back to Austin after 15 years away. Let's just say that, okay? Yeah. Hey, guys, I really want to thank you all for coming in tonight and doing this. Talking about Kevin's record, which we've had a really good time. And thanks, Matt, for coming back.
Thanks for having me again. It's great.
Wait.
We were going to talk about Russian Hill.
Yeah. No, let's. Oh, Russian Hill.
Oh, we didn't listen to it yet?
No. We have not.
Jay's like, everybody go home.
Sorry. Yeah, just get out of here, guys. Sorry, let's listen to it.
No, we were going to do
it. Just move it forward.
Well, no, one of the things that I
get lost in your eyes, Kevin. I have to say that.
Oh, sure. We all do. I get that a lot.
Yeah.
It's a Debbie Gibson song.
Electric Youth?
Ooh, our sister had her perfume when we were a kid. Electric Youth.
Anyway.
Anyhow.
All of this being what it is, one of the things I wanted to do was make sure that we included a song.
Well, wasn't Russian Hill the one that the critics all seemed to gel over?
Well, this is one of the – there was a scathing 1993 review from Spin when this record came out. Then, and essentially, like, those guys were – they pushed all their chips to the middle of the table on the grunge movement. And this record came out, and it was not that.
Meanwhile, they were not above putting Creed on the cover a few years later.
I agree. Yeah, and it's another one of these where I talk sometimes about how like there's some Pitchfork finds Religion 20 years after the fact and re-ranks records and re-rates them, and I think this is one of those that like under scrutiny holds up differently 20 years after the fact than in the individual snow globe that it was produced in during that time, and so. This is the song that those guys seemed to like in the moment, and I think part of the reason they liked it is it didn't sound like the rest of the things on the record, and part of the reason it wasn't is that it wasn't co-written. But yeah, let's give it a listen. This is Russian Hill. Yeah, so I think we can all agree that it's a counterbalance to a lot of what shows up on the rest of the record.
Well, it's not, you know, this upbeat, poppy, relentless thing. To me, it sounds like the beat, like Sgt. Pepper influence, specifically She's Leaving Home, and if you added like a little bit of like pedal steel to it.
Well, there's some pathos to it. I mean, it's quieted down, it's calmed down. Like they still have the counter melodies and all of that stuff going on, but in not a direct in your way or in your face kind of way.
I think it's cool because it's a nod, you know, they're a Bay Area band. It's, geographically, it's one of the seven hills, I think, that make up San Francisco.
That same thing.
So I think it's a cool nod to the city, the Bay Area they're from. But it kind of it gives you that feeling of, I don't know, late night San Francisco or something.
And I would say, I think that's true. And I would say the other thing is that, you know, in terms of the production value of this song, even though it's not over the top and the way that some of the other ones are, it's also clearly like well produced and clean. The production value is clean. And it sounds to me like, again, I thought it was a nice counterbalance to what they'd done with the, some of the rest of the record.
Yeah, it's a pretty song. Like, really pretty song.
So, Shane, you wanted to introduce a new segment, right?
Yeah, so we talked about this a little bit last week. And we're going to kind of try something out. This is going to become part of the show, I think.
Is this where we set Mark on fire?
Yep.
Whoa, dude.
Don't ruin the surprise.
Sorry.
Spoiler alert.
We haven't gone to the musical break yet. He doesn't know about this yet. Sorry, Mark.
We were going to have Matt do it because he's not here all the time. Yeah.
Kevin,
why? Because I'm Mexican. What the hell?
Oh, God, this is why I opened my kid's birthday present.
Yeah, like you were saying before the show started, I'm a little bit out of practice. Yeah, you're a lot out of practice, dude.
I'm like Jesus. David Lee Roth in a Napoleon costume right now,
or a Quasimodo costume. Take your fucking
watching
bed.
TV. Yeah.
So we talked about this last week, and that is I'd like to move a segment into the last part of the show where we take a song from the last year. I said 5 years. I don't know why. Mark quickly pointed my – no, Mark like put his hand on my arm. He's like, no.
You are wrong, my friend.
No, it's a year.
Help me help you.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay.
A recent song.
So there's no – and you guys – I don't think that there should be any criteria at all. No genre, no level. It could be from Taylor Swift, or it could be from a dude that gives me his album in the parking lot of a Walgreens. The only criteria I think should be, it should be at least 12 months or less from the date that we're talking
about.
Well,
and the one you've selected is the, what, forthcoming single?
It's not forthcoming. It's already.
Well, I mean, it's out, but the record's not out, right?
Yeah, the record's not out.
Can I ask you what should happen if Taylor Swift gives you her album in a parking lot?
I will put my coat around her like a bodyguard and shepherd her into my car because I'll know she needs to go somewhere and she's not feeling well.
She clearly doesn't have any of her. Heavy entourage She's suffering
from exhaustion.
And it will clearly turn into a madcap comedy wherein I am the Hugh Grant character.
In some
Benny
like
Hill
not.
Music plays. And
that makes it even better. Can you imagine like Hugh Grant with Benny Hill and he's stuttering?
I just want to...
I'm sorry, not...
I love this... What'd you say, Producer Mark?
This is a great new segment, guy.
I think you're right about this. Okay, so this week we are going to play Bridges by Broods. Broods is a duo from New Zealand. They've been produced by the same producer that produced the album that brought Lord to prominence. But this video in particular, that was incredibly Texan, the way that I said that. In particular, this goddamn
going
song,
to the McDonald's.
That's pretty damn good, man. Hey, that blonde girl.
Can I ask where in New Zealand? Just out of curiosity.
This band Broods, or this duo Broods, is from New Zealand, and they have been produced by the same producer that produced Lord's Pure Heroine, however you'd like to, and. We're going to go and watch this video real quick. And I put this on Ryan a couple of weeks ago, and I was like, watch this. You're going to have to watch it more than once because you're not.
I have only watched it once, but I'll watch it again with fresh eyes.
We'll be right back. So we all just watched the video. I think that's a great song, by the way. I don't know.
Great song, beautifully shot video. Takes some dissection to get there with it.
Yeah, I don't know how you guys feel about... well, I know Ryan and I both... I sent this over, like, Christmas break, drunkenly sent to Ryan, like, you've got to watch this video, but it's going to take you second viewing to see it. But it took a little more than a second viewing. So this act, this two-person act... male-female duo out of where in New Zealand?
Nelson.
Okay, so we talked about this. Did you guys...
We just watched it for the first time, for me, at least.
Mm-hmm. So in the video, it looks essentially...
Two adolescents,
like, doing all of these, like...
One of whom is Leonard Nimoy.
True.
At age 15.
Yes, and one of whom looks like a Sissy Spacek when she was in...
Carrie?
No, not maybe.
Actually, and
our
not,
cousin
yes,
discovered her.
Discovered by a relative of Ryan's and mine. But whatever. No, anyway, but yeah,
I was thinking Badlands.
Oh, okay.
But...
So Mark is showing where on the island that town is, and apparently it seems to be.
It's
on the
nowhere near.
Nope. Yeah. Okay. But,
okay. Because everybody knows in the States, in
Wellington, New Zealand.
It's on the northernmost
point. Is that
point
the city that they
New
named
Zealand.
The northern after?
Northernmost
the,
point.
The,
of the
beef
island.
Pastry okay, dish,
well,
I believe.
I'm just looking at
came
the
from there.
Oh. So, in the video.
Okay. Northernmost. Mark's right. Northernmost point of the Southern Island. In this geographical podcast. Anyway, so getting back to the video, it's this this situation where you've got a couple.
Well, it looks like a couple of young lovers, like, you know,
high school age.
Yeah, lovers. like first love, like just having a great time, and then it takes a turn.
Yeah, so you notice. Well, you don't notice it the first time through. Like they're doing all these fun things, like he's riding around on a scooter, he's riding her around on a scooter, and then he's riding on a scooter, and she's like. Doing a matador cape to the scooter, and they're doing all these things. They're like in a church, and she's like,
yeah, she's like hopping over pews and holding his hand, and
it's adorable. They're in a mall at one point, but throughout that, you don't notice this at first. He's quite melancholy. Like the opening shot, she's behind. He's sitting in a chair. She's behind him, and she puts her fingers on the corners of his mouth and pulls him up into a smile. So anyway, toward the end of the video. They do this quick cut thing where you realize that he's wrapped her up in a sheet and tries to suffocate her with a pillow, and then it quick cuts to this other thing.
Well, he tried to kiss her, and she rebuffed him.
No, but that's in the other part. So later, he tries to kiss her, and she rebuffs him, but he's got his jaw clenched. It's just like this...
So if you go back and watch it again, you notice the subtle cues. They're not actually a couple. He's just this guy who's pining for his best friend, and she's having none of it.
Yeah, but he's also violent about it.
And so, it turns dark.
I highly recommend...
It's a beautiful song, and the video's beautifully shot.
Yeah, that's the thing that Ryan said to me. I asked him to listen to this. So a couple of shows ago, I was like, did you watch that video? And he's like, yeah, it's beautifully shot. And I was like, oh, you didn't really see what was going on. I mean, because it's such a good song. It's like a kind of a synth pop. It's really similar to a lot of the stuff that Lorde does. Matt's raising his hand.
So, but the thing that kind of gives away your setup here, I think, at the very end, he walks into this red room with a lot of smoke, and it's almost too literal for me because it's almost like
his own personal hell.
Yeah.
Oh no, I agree. Like that's where you're right. It is. It gets too literal. It before there's a scene before that where he pens her down and stuff, and they're wearing like
plastic vampire teeth.
Plastic vampire teeth. Yeah, thanks. And so after that, he's like just sitting there after she leaves because there's like a big exit that she does. Well, I guess it's pretty subtle, actually. And he's standing there looking at these vampire teeth, and then you sort of like, oh, it's the inner demon. And then he sees like down the hall of this thing, there's a room that like smoke starts coming out of, and it's red. Like you're right, it is too literal. But the video before that is really subtle.
Yeah, I will say this: what I appreciate about this is that it doesn't seem that there's very many sort of ambitious narrative videos anymore. Like
Pretty Woman. I mean, I can,
dude. Well, that's the ultimate
point. I've got to tell you guys, it's been a long, long, long time since I've seen a video that put chills on my arms like this Bridges video. But before we watched it tonight, I was hanging my head in sadness that I hadn't had that come before the Pretty Woman video in this podcast, because that is the greatest narrative video or video that's ever been
just
created.
Greatest video of all time,
probably.
Pretty Woman.
You want to show me another one at this point,
dude? I got nothing. I got nothing to top that thing, man.
No. I have this like sad, serious. No. And I love the fact that there's like this part at the end where we're like,
it's like you had to follow Bill Hicks or something.
And Matt's like, yeah, but here's the curveball, and that's why this isn't a great video. But at the same time, he's perfectly willing to go on with it. Oh, but I did love the fact that you pointed out that there was a double for Eddie Van Halen whenever he twirled his gun in Pretty Woman.
Well, yeah.
He can play guitar, but he can't sling a gun.
That's not Eddie.
It's the classic editing.
Kids, we should probably move
this
along.
Let's get out of here. So,
I want to make sure that we, again, take a second to thank Matt for joining us. Like, lots of little cool nuggets.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Mr. Munoz, we do appreciate it.
Yeah, guys. Matt, we'd love to have you back soon.
Let us know.
Most time, I don't like Matt at all, but I really like him tonight. I don't know what the hell.
There you go.
Next time, I don't want you in a tracksuit. I want you in, like, full, like, three-piece suit, mafia regalia.
Bring the samurai outfit from Pretty Woman.
or just come dressed in what you are now, but bring an entourage. Yeah.
Bring about three other guys with me.
Who just
like
nod a lot and look scary. It's
good. Stand behind me.
All right, let's get out of here. All right, we'll see you next week with the Kinks of the Village Green Preservation Society. I'm Shane.
I'm Ryan.
Matt.
For producer Mark, I'm Kevin.
And for Kevin, I'm Mark.
Somebody likes it.